Hi, Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind, A Trackless Path 2, Part 13.
Wednesday, August 11th, Trackless Path 2, Morning Session. I want to go through the rest of the wisdom experience of ever-present good this morning. There's some other things I want to turn attention to this evening. As Larry pointed out yesterday, in a certain sense, one's saying the same thing over and over again, many different ways. So, awakening mind free from discarding or attaining Buddha nature, the essence of awareness is present in you. Still, it is stuck in a cage of inventions. All meditation just clouds the heart of the matter. Is everybody with me? Page 28. The beginning of what's actually called the third chapter, where about just over halfway down the page. In this presentation, one way to look at it is that it goes back and forth between describing really three things. Trying to put into words this way of experiencing things, it's one. The mechanisms that prevent it from arising, that's two. And three, instructions which move you in the direction of experiencing things this way. Those three elements are interwoven all through Jigme Lingpa's writings here. So, awakening mind, free from discarding or attaining Buddha nature, the essence of awareness, is present in you. As I've said before, this isn't a statement of fact. This is a description of experience. We find in our experience when we rest deeply or when a lot of the habituated functionings fall away, this extraordinary clarity and openness in which there is no sense of subject and object, which is has termed various terms, awakening mind, Buddha nature, essence of awareness. We find it in our experience. It's not a thing, it is itself a way of experiencing. And then the next part, still it is stuck in a cage of inventions. That's a description of the situation. There's this possibility in us, and yet all of the stuff is going on, which, and there's a metaphor of the cage. It's like this, it's caged it can't get out. We can't access it. And then the fourth line, all meditation just clouds the heart of the matter. That's actually instruction. You know, and it's saying what he said over and over again, don't do anything. So you go into the next stanza. In pure being, which is without origin or essence, what is experienced has no beginning or end. That again is description of experience. Your misconceptions twist what is formless into form. That's a description of the mechanisms. Slipping away from what is true, you become confused and reactive. That's what happens. Some people cut off the ebb and flow of thoughts and feelings and construct an emptiness practice corrupted by goal-seeking. So now he's saying, this is how some people try to do it, and this is the result. And I come across this all the time, with people who are try to stop the flow of thoughts. Gunaratna, who's a Theravadan teacher in Virginia, I think, very, very good. I once listened to him describe the meditation instruction and going into the four jhanas, and it was just like listening to a string quartet, and it's so clear, it's just beautiful. I mean, you could almost feel it happening in you as he described. It's just so what he says, thoughts are to mind what sweat is to the body. And Gampopa had a student, and Gampopa would be talking to his people and say, you know, I've got so and so up in the mountains, and he's really trying to stop thoughts. I don't know what to do with him. If he didn't regard thoughts as an enemy, he would have been enlightened a long time ago. So there's a phrase in Kagyu teaching which has become a big deal in some circles. Tibetan is Tamaji Shepa, and it just means ordinary mind, ordinary knowing. It's quite a wonderful phrase. It points to how we can experience things if we just don't do anything. It's that second part that's a little difficult. So trying to control or cut off this, the natural working of mind. If we look at mind as how we experience things, then this is a very forceful approach of trying to control how we experience things. This doesn't work. It always involves some kind of suppression. Here they construct an emptiness practice corrupted by goal-seeking. So they're able to create a kind of emptiness experience, which is no thought. But there's a... It's an artificial construct, and it is the expression of their ambition. There's no naturalness in it at all. They are worn out from pushing a forced practice. Big problems develop when you misdirect energy into the life channel. Now, that's referring to a wave, you might call it spiritual physiology. We always called it spiritual plumbing in the... you have the system of channels and energy moving through them, And it's a way of describing the arising of experience, which is used in high-level Vajrayana practice in order to understand, apply attention in various ways so that you transform basic energies of the body and they become available for attention and awareness. If you do this the wrong way, you get very, very ill. And you cannot heal these illnesses medically. One of my friends put it, the traditional warnings, death paralysis or insanity. And they're very real, very real. One of my students was doing some work at this level, and she got very, very ill, and I pulled her out of the retreat because her life was actually in danger. It's very disturbing. I know too many people who have gone crazy, literally, from doing this stuff. And it all comes because there are emotional elements that can't be allowed into experience, and that distortion forces energy into the system the wrong way, and you get very, very ill, and or go crazy. So this is a big warning against really trying to control your experience. You see this a lot, not only in Tibetan practice, it comes up in Theravada and in Zen in different ways. You see it in yoga, it comes up in Tai Chi, and anywhere where you're working with energy transformation techniques, or people, even if they aren't doing energy transformation techniques, if they're trying to make themselves experience things a certain way, you're going to get these kinds of problems. Others do not see original presence. Misled by descriptions of presence, their practice is ineffective. Taking an intense dullness that conceals thoughts and feelings as the essence of practice, they are very confused. This is very, very common also, where people hear these descriptions and they construct an idea of it and then try to duplicate that idea. But because there isn't a direct experience of the extraordinary clarity and openness, they're wandering around in the dark, quite literally. And they will often mistake, certain states of what actually are dullness as openness and so forth, and the confusion just goes on and on. It's why it is helpful to have interaction with the teacher, so that you aren't relying solely on your own sense of being awake. Interaction with other people quickly reveals whether it is contrived or natural. Some use their ability to know movement as mind to mull over the traces of thoughts as feelings. Thoughts and feelings ebb and flow. People who track arising and fading in stable meditation just spin in confusion even if they practice for 100 years. We talked about this much earlier in the retreat. This is taking the noting practice too far. And you just constantly tracking your progress. And there's the considerable danger in the way that much Buddhism is being taught, where there's been this blurring of lines between Buddhism and psychotherapy, and a lot of people are using their meditation as a way to do psychotherapy with themselves, so they're constantly ruminating about stuff. And it's not going to, I mean, that may be helpful from a therapeutic point of view, but it's not going to be very helpful from dropping into awareness, into this different way of experiencing things. And I've been to various centers, and it's actually quite disheartening sometimes, because all the words are right, but what people are doing in their practice is they're very definite states of mind that they're trying to cultivate, and so there's a great operation of preference going on. And this is one of the important aspects of equanimity, is that as your practice develops, one of the things that's very important is to become totally, to accept whatever arises and be in that experience. And I mean, that's far from easy, but it's very, very important. In general, work and effort alone just create opposition. You aren't happy when you practice, you stir up all sorts of pains. When you don't practice, you don't know your own nature and wander in confusion. In either case, you fall away from what is natural and true. One of the things that's come to me through my own efforts is philosophy, which I sum up in the single sentence, there is no enemy. It's not particularly easy. I spend very, very long periods of my time practicing, trying to get rid of certain very, very painful experiences. The degree to which you have to accept whatever arises, I mean, it's hard. But and for some people it is going to be harder than others. Dukal Urgen was a wonderful teacher who died in Nepal a few years ago. He would say, you know, some people have to work at this so hard, and other people, it just falls into their lap. Life's not fair. And people would say, well, if they haven't had to work hard at it, then it isn't really awakening. And he would say, no, that's not the case at all. Some people, we have very, very difficult stuff in our background, and so it can be extremely difficult to find the... to develop the capacity and courage and whatever, to be able to receive experience what has been blocked and stored away for a very, very long time. And other people, they don't have that stuff in their past, and so they just sit down and things open. In traditional explanations, it would be good and bad karma, you see. But it's just a way of explaining why things are different and doesn't really do anything other than provide explanations. The fact is, we have the bodies that we're born with, we have the circumstances of life which we've encountered, and that's it. But what I've found is... if you can really not oppose any experience, a lot of things get a lot simpler. But I won't say it's easy. So, because these mistakes stop you from going beyond ordinary human experience, it's just listed a whole bunch of mistakes. Now he's going to, Jigme Lingpa is going to describe what to do. Be clear that the approach of meditation versus not meditation relies on an artificial distinction. Be present right now without trying to change or control anything. And he's saying the same thing as there is no enemy right in that last line. Be present right now without trying to change or control anything. Put a complete stop to any kind of scrutiny, control, or goal-seeking using conditioned states of mind. Now again, here this is extremely easy to misinterpret. And a lot of people would say, okay, I'm just going to stop that. It's not how it works in practice. How it works in practice is you're going to fall into this. You'll find yourself, oh, am I meditating the right way? Am I doing the right thing right now? You've got to find yourself doing that. And as soon as you notice that you're doing it, go to your body, be present with what's there. That will stop it for a millisecond or two. So it's not a case of blocking it. It's a case of stepping out of it whenever you recognize that it's there. And you'll find layers and layers of subtler and subtler forms of control. And you do keep doing the same thing. Just, oh, there it is. And Kala Rinpoche used to, his one-line instruction which he gave to us over and over again was, just recognize. Just recognize. Mind is resting, just recognize it. Mind is moving, just recognize. So it's just that little bit of wakefulness. So you know what's going on. And that's it. Just recognize. Direct awareness is no big deal. And doesn't need any work. Stop trying to change or adjust it. Just let it be. Here it sounds like direct awareness is a thing. No, it's how you're experiencing. So, another way of saying this is just be in your experience and don't do anything about it. And it's very, very hard because we always want things to be just a little bit different. A lot. Whenever conceptual thinking arises, and this is a wonderful stanza, whenever conceptual thinking arises, don't look at what arises. Be what knows the arising. So you're right in the movement. Like an oak stake in hard ground, stand firm in awareness that knows and go deep into the mystery. When you do this, it's like stepping off a cliff. It's just like you're just in this and you have no control over what's arising. You're just in experience right there. And it may feel like you're falling. Well, the only reason we fear falling is because we think there's a bottom. And I've mentioned this several times before, but I really wish I'd saved this cartoon. But there's a two-panel cartoon. And in the first, there's two guys, a rooster and a dog. And the background is dead black. And one of the guys is just, his hair is all standing on end, his eyes are wide open, and there's just this look of pure terror in his face. And there's something similar on the other guy, and the dog, his legs are splayed, his mouth is wide open, and the rooster's feathers are just all over the place, and it's just flapping hysterically. And the caption reads, 3 seconds after falling into a bottomless abyss. The next, same four characters. One of the guys is like this. The other guy's like this. The dog's asleep. The rooster is perfectly composed. And the caption reads, 6 months after falling into a very good meditation instruction. So, Jigme Lingpa says here, don't look at what arises, be what knows the arising. There are actually two ways of practicing. One is to look at what arises, and the other is to look at what knows what arises. And different teachers actually will, and different traditions emphasize one or the other. They actually both end up in the same place, but in slightly different ways. And you may find one approach works better for you than the other. In the nature of what is, plain and simple, you may rest free from movement or change. If you don't avoid the trap of correctives based on positions, you will get lost in the ways of the analytic approach. This is why Suzaki Roshi says it takes 10 or 12 years working with someone who's read a philosophical text. Because there you're sitting, and you will have ideas about how things are arising and how things should be. And inevitably, and you're all cursed with this already, so you can't get away from this. And those will creep in. They're very, very subtle biases or prejudices about experience. Just recognize. And go back to falling. All the technicalities of outlook, practice, and behavior, and for a couple of people's, because they sent me notes about this, ground, path, and fruition are, from the perspective of what is true, just intellectual chaff. It's just stuff. It's ways of organizing and understanding experience. Some of it's very, very useful. But when you're practicing like this, let it all go. Let correctives that work on mindfulness subside into space. Maintain the chosen discipline of not naming, wandering or not wandering. I mean, it's you get the idea. Jigme Lymph is not giving you anything to hold on to. Let things be without messing around with projecting or absorbing. Those are technical techniques used in certain Vajrayana meditations. I don't need to go into them right now. Rest in space, free from the complications of effort. The great treasure is to be free of thought and thinking, to know that there is originally no Buddha, to be where wanting has never been. I'm taking those last two lines. To know that there is originally no Buddha. Anybody want their money back right now? This is a famous expression from the Zen tradition. If you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. And you have no idea how much consternation this arouses in people who don't understand what's being referred there. There's a woman I dated many years ago, and I told her a story I'd heard about the Dalai Lama, which I found quite delightful. And the story goes, it's just before he won the Nobel, or was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. He was flying in America, and this is when they still served meals on planes. And so he served a meal, and he was eating it, and the person next to him, the Westerner, said, isn't that meat you're eating? And the Dalai Lama said, yes, it's veal. It's quite good. And the Westerner said, but I thought Buddhists didn't eat meat. And the Dalai Lama said, only the serious ones. And this, I told the story to this woman, and she just said, you mean the Dalai Lama isn't a serious Buddhist? She just couldn't understand this. So, to know that there is a... Pardon? Oh yeah, this is I just like this isn't going anywhere. To know that there is originally no Buddha, I mean, with all the hullabaloo about Buddhism, it's a little frightening, but there we are. And to be where wanting has never been. I find this very useful thing because you read this and you go, oh. And it almost moves you there, just the phrase itself. Yeah. With a special teaching that rots the roots of samsara, wake up from the realm of misery. Open and relax an emptiness that goes beyond what is true or what is false. In the meaning of arising and releasing, self-releasing and direct releasing, you'll see in the footnote, these are three ways that thoughts release, thoughts, reactions, etc. release, and from the Dzogchen tradition. Know this, and you are no different from all the awakened ones. You'll awaken and be no different from me. And here, Jigme Lenpo, of course, is speaking as Samantabhadra. Next line, the next verse is a little bit important. In this age of strife, these key instructions of the great mystery are mingled with the authoritative writings of the analytic approach. In other words, they're buried. So this was deliberate. In traditional societies, one is presented with this way of practice only after one had gone through a great deal of training. And so this approach to practice really belonged to the privileged few who it was felt could actually make use of it. And the reason for this is that this level of instruction, this way of practice, was regarded as too dangerous for most people. Dangerous not only in the ways that I was describing, as that people would construct and try to enforce themselves and, you know, either kill themselves, drive themselves crazy, make themselves very ill, but also because there is this gives you so little to hold on to, it actually gives you nothing to hold on to, that for many people the reaction to this would either to be fall into despair and depression or slide into megalomania. Nothing matters, I can do whatever the hell I want, etc. And the purpose of all the preliminary training, developing the capacity, but wasn't simply about developing the capacity of attention, but was also developing the emotional capacity to be able to treat this, to be able to meet this complete openness without falling into despair or going into megalomania or solipsism or something like that. So these instructions were sprinkled through or interwoven with other texts, and it was through your training that you were able to, you were pointed out, okay, that belongs here and that belongs here. Those knowledge holders who are not different from me will confirm this wisdom experience. And here again we find one of the central principles of Buddhism, that the experience of contemporary masters is held to be of equal authority as what is written in the various sutras and traditional teachings. And this is one of the things that keeps Buddhism so alive. Masters of this teaching, the expression of the awakening beings of the three families, and those blessed with natural talent, may you make use of it. So, there you are. A little bit late for breakfast, but we will continue. Okay, any announcements?
retains all rights to these podcasts. If you do wish to use a part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.